evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Nabil Biagio, working from home on this pre-recorded program via remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Thursday, February 4th, 2021. The South Sudan government reinstated a partial COVID-19 lockdown after an uptick in cases.
We had the same move last year, and most of the time there's a decrease like this that usually is not followed by enforcement of what was decreed. For example, the social distancing, the transportation going halfway, and also gathering.
And a former Lord Resistance Army commander has been sentenced to life imprisonment.
This case is hugely significant because it is the first trial leading to a verdict of a Lord's Resistance Army leader anywhere in the world.
We will have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan has announced more restrictions aimed at preventing the spread of COVID-19 across the country. Hussein Abdelbaghi Akol, South Sudan's vice president in charge of the service cluster, said on Wednesday that of late the country is registering a rise in the number of COVID-19 cases. The restrictions include closure of learning institutions and a ban of social gatherings such as religious activities, including prayers in churches and mosques. Dr. Akwai Cham, an associate professor of public health at the University of Juba, welcomes the government's decision but says unless the government implements the order, COVID-19 will continue to spread. Waki Simon Wudu has this report from Juba.
The announcement comes several months after the government lifted some COVID-19 restrictions last May. Vice President of the country's service cluster, Hassan Abdelbaghi Akol, says all social gatherings, including religious and political events, are prohibited. All schools and universities will be closed except classes scheduled for examinations. All incoming passengers traveling from other countries into South Sudan must carry COVID-19 free test certificates to be allowed into the country. And the Council of Ministers will only hold extraordinary meetings. Akol says the government has ordered law enforcement agencies to enforce their restrictions.
All the uniform forces must strictly follow the COVID-19 and measures, and finally the National Task Force instruct the law enforcement agencies to take immediate action to impose the order.
The government first imposed similar restrictions in March last year but gradually lifted several of them. Akol says the National Task Force on COVID-19 decided to reimpose the restrictions because of a recent rise in the number of COVID-19 cases. In the past 2 weeks, South Sudan registered 358 positive cases, according to Akol. Prior to that time, daily figures ranged between 10 and 25 cases. Some South Sudanese in the capital Juba welcome the announcement but say they doubt the government will fully implement the restrictions. They say South Sudanese authorities and ordinary citizens have been reluctant to pay attention to COVID-19 preventive measures. Juba resident Nono Diana says the behavior of some South Sudanese, including government employees, pose a challenge to preventing transmission of the virus.
I remember going this last year, December, to one of the police stations at Melekia when I was wearing a mask. And, you know, the trauma that came, you know, policemen were asking, why are you putting on this mask? What is the problem? Imagine these are government officials. And can you please remove this mask? Are you the people who are still saying corona is there? So I think the government must start from these institutions to make sure that even within their facilities, they adhere to these restrictions.
Another Juba resident, Wani Steven, says most police officers and troops seen along roadways do not enforce COVID-19 safety measures.
Even if the traffic, the police, the army look along the road, they have not affecting it because like people don't understand about this policy, this action that has been issued by the vice president. So the relevance of that lockdown will not be much felt by the citizens. The only thing is to educate the public about preventive approach.
Dr. Akwai Cham, an associate professor of public health at the University of Juba, says the coronavirus remains a public health threat and wonders if the government will get serious this time about enforcing the restrictions.
For me, I need to look at what is going to be different this time, because we had the same move back last year, and most of the time there's a decrease like this. That usually is not followed by enforcement of what was decreed. For example, the social distancing, the transportation going halfway, and also gathering in places usually seem to continue.
Few preventive measures are being observed by the public in recent months. Church and mosque services have gone back into full swing, and most attendees do not wear face masks or observe social distancing. South Sudan so far has registered 4,267 cases. Positive cases, including 66 deaths and 3,634 recoveries. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
The International Criminal Court has convicted a commander of the Uganda-based Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, of war crimes and crimes against humanity and sentenced him to life imprisonment. The group, led by Joseph Kony, was organized in 1987 to fight against the Ugandan army in northern Uganda. Dominique Ongwen, born in northern Uganda, was abducted as a child and given military training. Elise Kepler is Associate Director of the International Justice Program at the U.S.-based Human Rights Watch. She spoke with VOA's James Batty before the guilty verdict was announced and said Ongwen was known as one of the ruthless commanders of the LRA. She says the LRA as a regional rebel group covering Uganda, South Sudan, Central African Republic, and Democratic Republic of Congo was responsible for the killings of more than 2,600 civilians and abductions of over 4,000 others. Kepler says the Ugandan government referred the group to the International Criminal Court in 2003, and in 2005 the ICC issued arrest warrants against the LRA's top five leaders at the time: Joseph Kony, Vincent Oti, Okot Odhiambo, Rasa Lukwiya, and Dominique Ongwen. Lukwiya, Oti, and Odhiambo were later killed. U.S. military advisors working with the African Union Task Force in Central African Republic took custody of Ongwen in 2015 and handed him over to the African Union. He made his pre-trial appearance before the ICC in January of the same year.
This case is hugely significant because it is the first trial leading to a verdict of a Lord's Resistance Army leader anywhere in the world. And as I'm sure some of your listeners know, the Lord's Resistance Army led by Joseph Kony is implicated in widespread atrocities first committed in the conflict in northern Uganda, then in other parts of the region, Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic. So it's a hugely significant case. The case has gone on for about 4 years. It started in 2016, and both sides have made their case, prosecution and defense, and it's ultimately up to the judges. I wouldn't want to predetermine or attempt to predetermine what they will say, but we will be watching closely to see how this trial concludes.
You know, Elise, before I even go into the case itself, Dominic has been referred to by some as an alleged perpetrator and a victim of the same offenses. What exactly does that mean?
It's a really important point. So Dominic Ongwen, in addition to being an alleged perpetrator, is also a victim. He himself, the Lord's Resistance Army was known for abducting children and recruiting them, forcing them to fight and commit abuses. And Dominic Ongwen was one such victim, abducted, believed to be at around the age of 10. It is then believed that he stayed within the Lord's Resistance Army and moved up the rank. But it does point out some of the complexities of a situation like this. You know, Human Rights Watch takes the position that the fact that one may at one time have been a victim cannot be a basis to negate responsibility, if it should exist, for the commission of crimes committed as an adult. But it is important that people not be tried for crimes committed under the age of 18 for these types of crimes, and that also one's role as a victim can certainly and probably should be a factor in any sentence if someone is convicted.
Elise, as you know, it takes two to tango, and the LRA would say that they were fighting against a government in Uganda, like President Museveni's government. So I'm interested in first knowing who brought the case against Dominic to the ICC, and what happened to the other side of the equation, meaning the Ugandan government and any alleged atrocities that the government military might have committed.
So the case came about because the Ugandan government asked the International Criminal Court to open an investigation into crimes committed by the Lord's Resistance Army. The International Criminal Court ultimately opened an investigation into all crimes committed in northern Uganda during the conflict, because the ICC isn't limited to one side or another, and in fact it shouldn't be. The International Criminal Court issued 5 arrest warrants for 5 Lord's Resistance Army leaders. 3 have since been declared or presumed dead. Joseph Kony, the leader, is still fugitive on the run. The International Criminal Court hasn't ruled out the possibility, but has signaled that their evidence doesn't point to the level of crime that would fall kind of within the focus of the International Criminal Court during the relevant time period. And I think it's really important to note here that the International Criminal Court's work really begins in 2002, but of course the conflict in northern Uganda started much earlier. And it has been cited that some of the most known alleged abuses by Ugandan armed forces did happen before that 2002 period, which may be some explanation as to how this has unfolded.
A team of investigators working on behalf of the World Health Organization visited on Wednesday a major virus research laboratory in China's central city of Wuhan. The team is looking into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Reuters' Flora Bradley Watson reports.
It's day 6 of their fact-finding mission into the origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Driving through thick morning mist, the team were bombarded by journalists' questions. Scientist Peter Daszak is the president of the EcoHealth Alliance.
We're looking forward to meeting with all the key people here and asking all the important questions that need to be asked.
The Wuhan Institute of Virology has been the subject of several conspiracy theories.
Did you find anything inside?
Some claim that a leak from the lab caused Wuhan's first coronavirus outbreak at the end of 2019. But most scientists reject that hypothesis. There have, however, been calls for the lab to release details of all coronavirus samples studied there. The WHO's fieldwork will last 2 weeks and has already taken them to hospitals and several markets in the central Chinese city. The trip has been plagued by delays, concern over access, and bickering between Beijing and Washington. Beijing has also repeatedly sought to cast doubt on the notion that the pandemic originated in China.
Federal health authorities continue urging Americans to wear masks, but how many? AP Washington correspondent Sagar Meghani reports.
Dr. Anthony Fauci says he gets asked a lot.
Should you be wearing 2 masks or 1 mask?
It's up to you.
I often myself wear 2 masks.
Fauci notes there's no official recommendation on what's better since there's no data yet to prove it. CDC Chief Rochelle Walensky says the agency's actively looking.
More data will be forthcoming from the CDC with regard to the value of double masking.
Sagar Meghani, Washington.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, South Sudanese Olympians hope to win a medal for South Sudan. Find out more when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. question today.
What is your favorite meal?
I like chips and anything braai, whether chicken or beef.
My favorite meal is our fish, mainly jambo, and local vegetables like nkwani.
I love chapati. Like, I don't know why I love chapati, but I just love chapati. There's no reason for loving it. Like, chapati every day.
My favorite meal is jollof and rice with chicken. That will be best for me.
My favorite food, matoke, that is banana and beans. Banana and beans, yes.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. A local NGO is encouraging local tourism to promote peace in South Sudan. Lupai Samuel, the executive director of I Am Peace Initiative, created a peace camp platform to bring young South Sudanese from all walks of life and communities to connect with one another. The peace camp toured Numuli Town this weekend, where the youth visited different tourist attractions, including the Fula Falls. Participants say, even though they visited the various sites free of charge, they believe in future local tourism will not only boost the economy, but also enable youth from various communities to build trust as well as promote peaceful coexistence in the country. David Monodanga traveled with the local tourists and files this report from Juba.
From a distance, one could hear the roar of white water at Fula Falls, falling down the base of the Nile and crashing on the rocks below, sending foamy splashes of water up as high as 5 feet. Lupai Samuel, executive director of the I Am Peace Initiative, says the peace camp brings together youths from various communities to build trust, break stereotypes, and promote peaceful coexistence in the country.
We realize that one of the things young people are always apart in smaller groups is because they don't have a platform to come together, and there's no intention that brings them. But when we create that platform, they start to connect at different levels, and that's the objective of the peace camp, building people-to-people relationships to build trust and break stereotypes.
Samuel says South Sudanese need to connect with their country, explore its physical features, and take advantage of its tourism opportunities. He says the camp enables youth to do more than just connect with each other.
It means connecting with nature. It means connecting with what can sell South Sudan out there to make us proud of our country. And so selling the local tourism of this country means that other people are going to know South Sudan besides the wars that they hear and besides all the horrible things we hear about South Sudan. And promoting local tourism means there's a positive aspect of this country that is untapped into, and the young people are the best people to tap into this.
Christine Kide, one of the youths who took part in the peace camp, says the Fula Falls are beautiful, as are many areas of South Sudan.
We can't deny the fact that South Sudan is truly beautiful and blessed from the natural beauty, the hills, and when we go to the falls, you know, looking at how God designed the falls and the elephant, the buffaloes, it was quite an amazing experience. So just that these natural resources are not well taken care of, or maybe they are not well planned for, is becoming a challenge to access them, to give people an opportunity to see the beauty of South Sudan.
The River Nile's floodplains are rich in green vegetation and fertile soil, an essential natural resource for robust agricultural activities along the Nile and recreational opportunities such as hiking the Gordon Hills, which offers stunning view of flowering vegetation at the Nile floodways. The floodplains also provide a habitat to a diverse variety of wildlife, including elephants, monkeys, buffaloes, hippopotamus, and reptiles.
When you look across the river, we saw elephants grazing on the other side, and we saw how powerful the waves were. It made us really look into the future and think maybe in the next 10 years we might have electricity being generated in our own country. If the roads can be developed, you know, paved to allow people to visit the sites, you know, to go and study, see the nature, and then it would really be amazing.
Eva Lopa, who works for Advanced Youth Radio, says Fula Falls could be South Sudan's gateway to commercial tourism, which would boost the economy. She says the falls could also generate electricity for the country. Lopa says local tourism needs to be promoted across the country.
Tourism contributes to building an amazing economy, and it's only a disappointment that we are not making use of having something so great. Another thing that I've seen about the Fula Falls is the opportunity it gives electricity a kick off, not just to the Nimuli people, but to the entire of South Sudan.
The Peace Campus also visited archaeological sites such as the Calvary Chapel Kush and the 200-year-old tamarind tree that Sir Samuel Baker, the British explorer, used to sit under with local chiefs in the Maryland to settle cases that affected communities in Nimule, which included the slave trade in the late 1860s and early 1870s. For VOA News, I am David Monodanga in Juba.
South Sudanese athletes training in Japan for the upcoming Tokyo Games hope to become the first Olympians in history to win a medal for South Sudan. My VOA colleague Gwen Uden has their story.
According to a report released by the Metropolitan Government of Tokyo, the Japanese capital saw nearly 40,000 new coronavirus cases in January. That figure nearly doubles the previous record number in December and increases the likelihood that the region's current state of emergency, due to end on February 7th, will be extended. Amid growing concerns about the record surge in positive infections across the country, 80% of those polled in Japan say they want to see the Olympics either postponed or canceled. But despite uncertainty over this summer's delayed games, South Sudanese track athletes and their coach are training as if the event will go on. In 2019, the team arrived in Japan well ahead of the original start of the Olympics to take advantage of the country's training facilities, and they were putting the final touches on their workouts when the games were postponed. However, 18-year-old South Sudanese hurdler Akuna Kuhn tells Reuters the extra year of training has worked to his benefit.
Oh, for me, I don't have any care about that. I'm just continue with my training. If that be help, it's okay. Yeah, and that is all. I don't want to confuse my mind. I just focus on my training, and that is all.
But for team coach Joseph Omorok, the year-long delay has come with a big sacrifice.
When the decision come out from the university and the South Sudan Olympic Committee that we are going to continue here for another year again, so actually I was worried because on my outside from my children, it is hard for me. After now, it is hard. But because of the mission, it is a government mission, so I decided to be here.
The South Sudanese team made the nearly 7,000-mile trip to Japan from the world's youngest country. In 2013, 2 years after declaring its independence from Sudan, South Sudan descended into a civil war that left an estimated 400,000 people dead and forced millions from their homes. Akun, who also competes in the 400 meters, says he's proud to represent his country and to bring a message of peace and hope to the people of South Sudan.
And it's been a lot to me even to participate in Olympic. It's not easy. That is the greatest chance. And I'm so happy to be here. To present my country. That's why in the training, I train hard to make something better.
South Sudanese sprinter Michael Machek has made headlines since he began his training in Maibashi. He's astonished many onlookers with his fast times despite an upper limb disability on his right arm and hand. Machek's motto is disability is not inability and says he has two jobs to do in the upcoming Olympic Games. First, to give love, compassion, and support back to the people of Japan, and second, to inspire youth back home as the country's first Paralympic athlete.
This is the first time to come out of my country, to go to other country, and I am now in Japan. So I feel very proud about that. Seeing I acquired something here, I will go back to South Sudan and transfer to my young Kamas athlete, so that they will come to reach to our level.
This summer, the South Sudanese athletes will represent their country at the Games for only a second time. South Sudan made its first ever appearance in 2016 at the Rio Games. However, a South Sudanese athlete has yet to bring home a medal. The Tokyo Olympics are set to begin on July 23rd, and the Paralympics will kick off 1 month later on August 24th. For South Sudan in Focus, I'm Gwen Uten in Washington.
We love to hear what you think about this show. Send your brief comments about issues in our news or happening in your area. Our WhatsApp number is +1-202-630-8011. We will air your comments every Friday. And that's our show for this Thursday. We now leave you with the song Sapeur by Awilo Lagomba.
Il était comment? Mobali ayaya, bien coiffé, bien rasé, bien parfumé, n'a pas griffe à somme. Oh, oh, yeah, yeah.
Nom de Dieu, docteur, chef, j'adile.
Listening to Awilo Lagomba with his song Sapeur. I am Nabil Biagio in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to always wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, wear a mask when you're in public places, and do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.